Okay, we have a couple of sponsors here at the Happy Cast, which is nice. Has been a little bit. One of them is Are You the Kind of Music Geek, where every track in an album matters, even the weird fillery ones like Mother on The Police's Synchronicity. By simple virtue of the wonderful fact that they exist, then straddle the line with Discord and Rhyme, an album discussion podcast that is only sometimes about Duran Duran, as if that's a bad thing. Every episode, a rotating band of four hosts takes apart an interesting album and discuss it song by song. Discord and Rhyme is genre omnivorous. So far, we've had Earth, Wind, and Fire. Wow, all four of them. Ween, Aretha Franklin, Janet Jackson, Joni Mitchell, hip-hop supergroups, Deltron 3030. Oh, they were great. And a complete breakdown of Todd Rundgren's A Wizard, A True Star, featuring Washington Post reporter and certified prog nerd David Weigel, who we totally need to get on the podcast. He's a great guy. Both of our January episodes have been devoted to both sides of the crazy world of George Clinton, Parliament, and Funkadelic. And a bonus aside for Nathan, we reference Weird Al constantly, as well you should. He's very important. Discord and Rhyme is available alternate Tuesdays wherever podcasts are found. And similarly exciting news, we're also sponsored by Childproof. Childproof is an unproduced TV sitcom written by Tony Martin and Serena Rowell. I hope I pronounced that correctly. The six episodes starring Tina Martin and Geraldine Quinn were performed live at the 2017 Melbourne Fringe and then released as a podcast. It concerns those controversial types, the child-free by choice. They've been called selfish, immature, unfulfilled, even un-Australian. By their own families, out of step with a world that exalts the traditional family unit above all else, Ian and Jennifer are also battling extinction in their workplaces, commercial radio, and book publishing. It also won the Best Comedy Podcast at the 2018 Australian Podcast Awards. Ooh.
There is a sixth dimension beyond that which is known to reasonable man. It is a dimension as vast as Gallagher's talent and as timeless as when Justin McKelly. It is the middle ground between good taste and terrible judgment, between flops and fiascos, and it lies between the pit of puny man-animal's fears and the summit of Oogie Love's knowledge. This is the dimension of grudging toleration. It is an area which we call Nathan Raven's Happy Cast. Listeners, and welcome to the latest episode of Nathan Rabin's Happy Cast. I, alas, am not Nathan Rabin. I am, in fact, Clint Worthington. I am a senior writer for Consequence of Sound, podcaster extraordinaire, and currently talking to a plastic plant.
I'm Frightmaster M. Night Shyamalan!
Twist!
No, that was the twist here. No, my name is Nathan Rabin of the eponymous Nathan Rabin's Happy Place and Nathan Rabin's Happy Cast.
And with us, we have a very special guest, a returning guest, a lovely guest, Eric Jishka from We Hate Movies. Hello, Eric.
Hello. Oh, wow. You got the pronunciation.
I know. I learned my lesson. It's one of those weird things where, like, in the middle of saying it, I'm like, am I getting this right? No, it's fine. Just push through.
My family kind of Americanized it, bastardized it to Siska. But I often get comments of like, why aren't you going by Shishka? What's wrong with Shishka?
Anyway, yeah, why don't you tell the people what you do and where they can find you doing it?
Right. Well, you can find me doing stuff. Oh, my Lord, that sounds scary. I'm one of the hosts.
Like that Ted Bundy fellow.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I want to keep that under wraps, but I'm on the We Hate Movies podcast. You can get that wherever podcasts are. Also, whmpodcast.com. Yeah.
Excellent. And we brought you back to the show to talk about everyone's favorite batshit crazy auteur, M. Night Shyamalan, because he just put out a new movie a couple weeks ago, like in the midst of like what was going to kind of and kind of still is a comeback. And yeah. Is like being trounced by critics, but is actually having a pretty decent run at the box office. We're going to talk about Glass. Then we're going to go back and talk about one of his like many his string of many failures before Glass, The Happening. Our favorite movie about trees and wind and Mark Wahlberg and tiramisu subplots. Speaking of disasters, we'll also talk about the Fyre Festival and the two documentaries that just came out surrounding it. But yeah, but first we do have a Patreon, patreon.com/NathanRabinsHappyCast. I am pleased to report that we not only have met but have exceeded our goal of at least one new patron per episode. So I want to thank Taylor and Carl for their new pledges, for being new patrons, and also Steven for boosting your pledge. You were already pledging to us before, and then you decided to pledge more money to us, and for that we are eternally grateful. You will be the last to go in the ensuing apocalypse. So yeah, if you want to join their illustrious number, go to patreon.com/NathanRabinsHappyCast. But without further ado, let's just go into this. Let's get started with some scalding hot takes. Glass is here, a movie that, according to the little splash image at my press screening, was 19 years in the making. What probably happened, which was M. Night Shyamalan made Split and decided, you know, it'd be kind of funny. I'm going to call my buddy Bruce and have him like sit on a diner counter at the end of my movie to be like, twist, it's actually part of the Unbreakable universe. And then he actually
had convinced that's what happened.
Bruce Willis is nobody's friend in 2018. I'm guessing from his performance that he was legally obligated to perform in this, or somebody was threatening his family. Because those are the only two reasons there was... And the crazy thing about this is, like, I fucking loved him in Unbreakable. Like, I think that's one of his most interesting and dynamic and complex and nuanced performances. And he, again, he brings the Jeb Bush level of energy and excitement. He seems perpetually in danger of taking a nap.
Please clap.
His kryptonite is clapping, yeah.
His superhero name is the Overseer.
Yeah.
The Overseer! That's the most boring fucking name I've ever heard for a superhero. He might as well be like the Comptroller.
I've been calling him the Unbreakable Man.
Yeah. That's better! That's so much better! Yeah. And the only way that this could have redeemed itself would have been if his catchphrase was, "You've just been overseen." You know, you just got oversaw. Well, you know, he's got to have a little, and he looks like the fucking Gordon Fisherman. If he was wearing a hoodie, like, again, I just feel bad. It just felt like he was just thinking all the time about, you know, I've got a direct-to-video movie in Bulgaria with Dolph Lundgren's nephew to film. Yeah. I just need to get through this shit as quickly as possible so I can film my 7 other movies this month. I did not care for this motion picture, as you might guess.
Yeah, it's really bizarre because Unbreakable and Split feel like... two different ends of like the good parts of M. Night Shyamalan's career, right? Where like Unbreakable came out right on the heels of Sixth Sense. It was a huge success. Sixth Sense was a huge success. He'd arrived. Unbreakable was also critically well received. Then he had this downward slide.
Although
wasn't that
critically well received? I mean, the thing that's kind of interesting about that is I feel like it was kind of received.
Oh, was it sort of like it sort of came later?
Well, it was one of your overreaching, messy follow-ups to these kind of universally beloved movies. I think kind of the sense that this was his masterpiece and this was better than The Sixth Sense and more interesting and more deep. I think that came a little bit later. I'm certainly of that mindset. Uh-huh. It was kind of like a bit like, the Royal Tenenbaums after Rushmore or Magnolia after Boogie Nights, where initially they're kind of like, well, okay, this is obviously pretty great, but very messy and a little lesser than what came before. And then I think time has revealed them to be greater than what they followed in a lot of
ways.
And
then Split turned out to be kind of a bit of an upswing for M. Night as well, after sort of dropping off the radar after Earth, which, spoiler alert, hot take, and you know this, Nathan, I actually admire that movie in a lot of really weird ways, and I actually got to write about it for Sci-Fi, which was great, because between the time that I wrote that and Glass reviews started coming out, I was like, oh, well, he's in the middle of an upswing. So we had to change it to be like, well, Split was great, Glass less. So.
My question for you, Clint, is how much did Jaden pay to write that piece? And did Will Smith sign the check?
He paid
as well?
Me in cryptic tweets that read like fortune cookie aphorisms, and my mind was blown. He taught me in knowledge. He paid me in knowledge.
Wow, what a genius!
He's like, you can inhabit the millennium along with everybody else.
So he paid me in like used DVD copies of the Kung Fu Kid.
This I don't know if this is a pointless tangent or not, but one of the things that's kind
on
of
our podcast, the answer
me,
is probably yes. Sort,
That's true. One thing that's fascinating to me about M. Night Shyamalan is people see, again, this kind of downward trend in his movies where people really liked The Sixth Sense and Unbreakable and Signs. And then, oh boy, The Village was like, it's pretty. It's got some ideas. And then by The Happening, people are literally saying this is maybe the worst movie ever made. And M. Night Shyamalan isn't the next Alfred Hitchcock or Steven Spielberg. He might be the worst filmmaker alive. And having just seen The Happening, I'm like, yeah, I can kind of fucking see that.
Right.
But the thing that's interesting to me and why I haven't actually written about him that much in my world of flops is even though his movies get terrible, terrible reviews, even though they're perceived as doing really, really badly, even though the buzz is god awful, they're consistently make a lot of money. Mm-hmm. The Village was a big moneymaker. The Happening was a big money. I mean, this was a solid fucking hit, which is kind of sad and kind of weird. After Earth made hundreds of millions of dollars, Avatar The Last Airbender. So it's this weird thing where even when we seemingly hate M. Night Shyamalan's movies, and, you know, I think with After Earth, part of what's interesting about that is that, you know, it's not a notorious project for
him. Yeah, he was the director for Hire.
Exactly. Avatar The Last Airbender, he's taken on somebody else's projects. So again, there's a sense of like, oh boy, he really fucking whiffed. And he did in the sense that he made terrible movies that people hate. He did not whiff, however, in the sense that they made a fuck ton of money, as did Glass, which I guess only made cost $20 million and has already grossed over $120 million.
Yeah, it's pretty wild because, I mean, I feel like the secret to M. Night's, like the threat of his comeback, weirdly enough, came through Jason.
Yeah.
Right, it feels like a thread anymore. What came through Jason Blum, because he teamed up with Blumhouse, which is a great outlet that specializes in just like making a bunch of low budget movies, and then when one hits, then it's great. Like Get Out was a Blumhouse production, like so that lent it a lot of credibility. And he also
Upgrade was another Blumhouse,
right?
Joint.
And it was great. And yeah, so things like The Visit, which was like his found footage thing. I don't know if that was a Blumhouse joint necessarily, but that seemed to me to be the beginning of his upswing. Because I think
it had the vibe, definitely. Yeah. And I genuinely like that. I mean, that's the one movie that he's made since the Golden Years that I can say, yeah, that's fucking scary and effective and nifty, and I wholeheartedly recommend it.
I still haven't seen that one. That's where they go to grandma's house,
it's a
found
footage
and it's
movie.
Like scary.
Yeah. But there's a twist, Eric.
Oh, really?
No shit.
But a twist that actually works.
Oh, my God. Grandma.
Kind of...
Wait. Grandma was Bruce Willis the whole time?
Grandma was just one of James McAvoy's personalities.
And the thing that's kind of interesting to me about The Visit, other than it being good and very uncharacteristic, was there was a sense of him being humbled.
Yeah.
At the idea of like, oh my God, I got this ridiculous. I got the kind of ego you generally need to be doing a bag of cocaine every day and directing on a horse. Like you're fucking Peter Bogdanovich, but he kind of got that just through people being very, very successful and people loving his movies. So it kind of felt like after Flop. Seeming flop. He's like, okay, I just need to show that I can make an effective horror movie that's not really reliant upon my name, my persona, my cult. And he did that with The Visit, and then he got his confidence up. And Split, I thought was just fucking obnoxious. I feel like sort of on a moral and ethical level, the whole idea of kind of taking mental illness and transforming it into super villainy and a huge gimmick and a... you know, an excuse to force James McAvoy to do literally every accent and broad character. It's like, God, I felt like I was watching a fucking one-man show, you know? I felt like I was watching James McAvoy's acting reel, you know?
You know I grew up next to all kinds of colorful characters. Here's the mailman now. Howdy, James.
I wanted him to, like, slide some Billy Crystal characters in there, you know? He's like, I'm the jazz man.
Oh, no.
I talk to the beast, and I say, hey, it's not mellow to kill all those cheerleader chickens. You know what I'm saying? They're like, this is somehow even more offensive than all of the things making fun of people with.
That is such a fair reading, and you're right that, you know, the whole mental illness aspect and the split personalities. But at the same time, from what I've seen, I haven't watched After Earth or The Visit, but I was like, whoa, this is the best M. Night Shyamalan movie in eons. Just seeing James McAvoy, I guess, was fun enough, and I would like to see him add The Postman to his repertoire.
I mean, he might as well just like throw in like Sling Blade, you know? These are incredibly broad characters.
Yeah.
And again, I just feel like I know that you're a good actor. The more you try to convince me that you're like the greatest actor ever, the more irritated I am by you, the less there is a character. And again, I mean, I kind of feel like part of what made Split effective at all was the sense that there was some rooting interest in his character, that there was some good in him, that there was a possibility that, you know, like these sort of fragile, childlike characters that understand the value or the difference between good and evil will defeat the beast, you know, will overtake the horde. And in here, he's just a fucking bad guy. You know, they just introduce you. And again, the whole essence of both of these movies was fundamentally deconstructionist. The whole idea of Unbreakable and why it was a fascinating, weird, and different movie in 2000/1999, was they weren't making a whole lot of superhero movies at that point. And then secondly, it doesn't reveal itself to be a superhero movie until very, very, very deep into its runtime. And with this, again, there's no surprise. It's all on the table. We know that Bruce Willis's character is a superhero. What we don't know is that he's the world's most boring and terrible serial killer. Same thing with James McAvoy's character. Like, we know that he's not just a weird dude wrestling with his intense, incredibly theatrical, incredibly phony, Manimal meets Sybil type mental illness. He's just a fucking bad guy. So there's nothing to be revealed except, so it made me very, very mad. What were your guys' experiences with Unbreakable and Split, respectively?
Eric, why don't you go first? Because I feel like we've been talking a lot.
Unbreakable, I saw it when it came out and I was like, oh, it's pretty good or whatever. But, you know, again, the critical reevaluation, I think, went on in my own mind when I rewatched it just a few weeks ago, gearing up for Glass. I geared up for Glass, which sounds sad.
Yeah. I was excited and I felt silly and foolish and deluded to get excited about a movie by M. Night Shyamalan in 2019.
And you're absolutely right about the whole deconstructionist thing. And it's like this Unbreakable felt like a movie that should come out now instead of back then. And it just seems like he's trying to catch back up to that concept by getting into Glass and it just doesn't work really completely. But Split, I had no hope for. I think that's what made me like it so much. It was like, there is no bar to there's no, you can't go any lower or something.
He shows baseline competency, then he wins. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, no, I think I'm pretty similar in opinion to you. I think Split for me, like in, you know, completely acknowledging the sort of ickiness of the mental illness angle, I think as a stripped down thriller, I think it basically works in that sort of lowered standards M. Night kind of way. And yeah, James McAvoy's really showy, but you know, in terms of it being an actor showcase for him, I sort of get it. On a basic level, Unbreakable and Split worked for me. And I think it's been a while since I've really gone back and rewatched Unbreakable, but I also agree that I think it came along at the right time, actually, when I think about it, because it's very interesting. It talks more about comic books than superhero movies, because superhero movies weren't really a thing. And I think that's Glass's biggest problem, honestly, because it tries to apply the same conversation to a world 20 years later where superheroes and comic books aren't these like weird freak things that Samuel L. Jackson is up for. We're living in a post-Avengers world. In fact, Glass probably wouldn't happen without the Avengers. And so it's trying so hard to pretend that it has salient points about comic book lore or superhero things or even superhero movies. They have Sam Jackson say the word avenge at some point. Who's going to avenge us?
Oh,
and then there's like
the
incessant exposition about the Osaka Tower. There's that that magazine cover that says, it's a marvel.
Oh, God. Here's the thing about the Osaka Marvel. This is what a tedious, clumsy, clunky superhero movie this is. Basically, this teases the idea that within an hour and 40 minutes, two characters, a good guy and a bad guy, will fight in front of a building. Again, that's like, if you wait at one point in our superhero movie, there will be a fight scene. You will see some action.
But
like, if you watch a television show, there are 17 of those motherfuckers in 22 minutes.
But what's crazy about that is like, And it's a letdown. We don't even see the building.
No, it's a bait and switch. We don't get to see the lazy, shitty, canned, hackneyed thing that we've been promised for.
Exactly. Will you settle for a parking lot?
And here's the thing. Here's probably the most frustrating thing about A, glass itself, and B, talking to people who like glass, is that they sell it as this like crazy subversion, isn't it? What a reversal of the standard Marvel formula, the standard action movie formula. I'm like, no, I mean, it doesn't work because you didn't replace it with anything interesting. And also, this movie cost $20 million, and that's mostly why.
Well, they saved a lot of money by not having the action, by not having any fight sequences, by not having any special effects. And again, I think they think that they're doing this whole genre a service. You know, there's a sense of... we're exploring comic books from this academic perspective, from this intellectual perspective. And again, there are so many scenes in here where you find characters like going into a comic book store to discover what comic books are. There are these things where they'll go to Google and they will Google what comic books
are. I remember walking
are.
Into my favorite comic book shop and going over to the villains section.
Oh my God.
So these are villains, huh?
And also, they don't reference any superhero other than Superman and Batman. Yeah. And I think that's because that's the only superheroes that they know. And also, that's the only superheroes that they think the audience knows. Because again, I feel like when they came out in 1999, 2000, the superhero movies was taking a nap. It was slumbering. It was getting ready so that it could take over the world again. In 2019, it's nothing but superhero movies and comic books. So the fact that it spends much of its runtime explaining to us what comic books are.
Like, guys, this year an Aquaman movie made more money than a Batman and Superman movie.
Jesus, it's fucking insane. It's absolutely insane. They completely dominated the culture, and that doesn't acknowledge this on any level.
We should have Glass really just talking about Nick Fury.
Well, and you know, like, they sidelined the title character for an hour.
Yes, he's like not even a thing. He's like, he's just in a comatose state or fake comatose state.
It's an opportunity for Sam Jackson to like twitch his face a lot and be like, I remember sitting in the theater thinking, oh man, it must have taken a lot of control for him to twitch his face like that. And I'm like, why am I thinking about this? Well, because for most of it, because it's a $20 million movie and most of that was probably spent on Bruce Willis and Sam Jackson's fees, most of it takes place in a mental hospital. It's basically One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. With Sarah Paulson as Dr. Ellie Staple.
As Dr. Explains a Lot.
As Dr. Explains a Lot, whose goal is to convince these superheroes and ostensibly the audience that they're not superheroes, which is, I think, what M. Night is going for in terms of like, oh, well, what if? I mean, because that was, I guess, the basic idea of Unbreakable too, right? Where like, if superpowers existed in the real world, they wouldn't seem all that remarkable. They
would just be a guy. The banality of it.
Yeah. But the problem is we as audience members have seen the amazing things these people can do. So the premise itself falls flat on its face. Like, how are you going to successfully convince me that they are not superheroes? And the answer is, we're not. They are superheroes, and Sarah Paulson's just part of a vicious conspiracy.
Which we needed more of. We needed more. I needed to see what the hell this whole group was more than them getting dinner.
Yeah.
like they all go to the same restaurant. I guess they all get the same reservation. Like, they booked the place out. But we didn't get
someone
that last
table. Someone
collected
some open table points. Someone collected some open table points.
We got to wait for this couple to finish and leave, and then we can have our evil meeting.
Were the bartenders part of the Four Clover Society or whatever?
I'd like to think that they only needed Guy Fieri establishments.
Yes.
To further.
We're rolling out, killing superheroes, going to diners.
This will be some doggy sauce Superman will never recover from. And again, this whole idea of that we're doing a cerebral, that we're doing an academic deconstruction, that we're blessed. And again, I think Knight thinks, I think if you get a medical degree, you understandably think that you're a very intelligent person. And on some level, you are a very intelligent person. Michael Crichton is that sort of fellow as well. But you also have the arrogance that lets you write things like Disclosure or Rising Sun or Lady in the Water. I think there's this kind of arrogance of, you know, God, what's that, the fucking... Malice, where Alec Baldwin's big line is, do I play God? No, I am God. And it's so perfect that Aaron Sorkin wrote that fucking line. And I think that's true of Knight, is he thinks he's fucking God. And he's playing with his action figures here. But instead of fighting, instead of clashing, they're just having weird, boring conversations about philosophy and about the essence of it. I'm like, come on, like, this is a superhero comic book movie unlike any other, and that it's incredibly boring and talky and there's no action in it, and the hero is called the fucking Overseer.
It does nothing with those main three characters you're there to see, and then it jams in all these other characters like David's son, the girl from Split, and the mother of Samuel L. Jackson, who's somehow younger than him.
She's either 5 years older or 5 years younger.
I think she is 5 years younger, and then we have those tertiary characters that just sit around and watch. They watch in the parking lot, and then they run over and say, he was bad to your dad too, man.
My dad could totally beat up your dad.
They're setting up Glass the Next Generation. They're setting up the next 100 comic books. And I'm like, I want to cancel this shit. I don't care about these characters. Mr. Glass was a great character in Unbreakable. He's not a great character here. No. You know, like, Samuel Jackson's still having fun. But again, he spends half of it pretending.
Everyone's locked in rooms
state.
For an hour.
Yeah. Seriously? Oh, and James McAvoy is just over the top as always. There's just nothing to this character and too much to the character at the same time.
Nathan, you touched on that whole thing of like the next generation, because how Samuel Jackson says, oh, this is an origin story. We're going to wake up the world by showing everyone that superheroes exist. What would that even, like, if they were to do a sequel, I couldn't imagine it. What would it even be? Why? You know?
Here's the idea was that they released a viral video showing that superheroes are totally a thing.
They sit around waiting to see it go viral, watching people at the fucking train station.
Presuming that everyone's looking at the same YouTube video at the same fucking time.
Exactly.
And here's the thing. It's 2019. Imagine a video showing up on YouTube of a guy lifting a car. That's not proof of superheroes. That's Florida Man on bath salts.
That's like a deep fake. That's like, that's
a deep fake.
You have $5,000 and you started going to special effects school.
Or someone's like doing a collab with Rocket Jump or something and like doing it's an effects demo so they can get on the next Marvel movie, you know?
But they do show that the reporters are saying, well, it looks like footage has been released illustrating that superheroes and supervillains are real now. It's a thing.
I'm convinced. That's ridiculous.
That's all that's needed.
That entire final act, I was just like, I was on the edge of my seat in that I was sinking so far into my seat that I was about to fall off of it. It was just so cringeworthy and so rushed. Like, if you thought that Split treated mental illness badly, God, wait till you see the way, like, Anya Taylor-Joy has, like, the way her character behaves in this one, where she's just this weird secondary character who has full-on Stockholmsies for Kevin. And just wants to like reach out to him and like, oh, I can fix him. And it's so fucking bizarre. And like, oh, I need to get close to touch this guy who like abused me and kidnapped me and almost murdered me.
And killed and ate my friends.
Right? Yeah. Oh, it's wild.
Misunderstood, you know?
He's just misunderstood.
I mean, that was 7 of his personalities are malevolent. 6 of them are okay. 47 are kind of in the middle. It's a crapshoot, you know?
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that we should put the guy down just because he's an insane supervillain.
Right, exactly. It's just, it's just so tedious. And then, like, the action is, like, sort of... There are, like, bits of the way they film the action that I thought were interesting. Like, just the feeling of how awkward a grapple between, like, Bruce Willis and James McAvoy's characters would be, where they're most of the time it's just, like, POV shots of them, like, just doing basic wrestling moves. But part of me, like, there was a weird charm to that for at least
second. What does the Overseer do? It seems like his way of fighting crime is to wander around bumping into people, and then some of the people he bumps into, it's like, oh shit, they like murdered a baby in the face. I better go stop them. This seems like a very, very time inefficient way of...
Well, you'd think that, but 1 out of 5 people have murdered a baby.
That is true.
he just guessed correctly, most of the time. Yeah, and there's just the whole, like, the idea of that rain poncho that is, like, it looks like a rain poncho, but it's so very clearly, like, designed by a costume designer. designer to look the most like a cape.
Yeah, it's like a Cape Crusader vibe. I kind of like the poncho, I got to admit.
Yeah, there's like, yeah, there's a bit about the poncho that I kind of like. But still, well, drape it over someone who cares about what the movie they're in.
The Spider-Verse gave us a superhero in sweatpants. This gave us a superhero in a poncho. With salt and pepper beard. Oh, dear God. I feel like Bruce Willis should just retire. He just doesn't care. And they're going to make 18 more fucking Die Hard movies and reboot it. And it's, I just feel bad for Bruce Willis because he clearly doesn't care about these movies any more than we do.
I think he has a rider in his contract where he only needs to show up for one day of filming for whatever movie he's in anymore.
Yeah, he was just completely checked out. And again, the idea of combining these two movies, on some level, I think it makes sense, but if you actually look at the actual nature of them,
yeah, I mean, both Unbreakable films are fundamentally incompatible.
Unbreakable, it's a serious film, it's a somber film, it's understated, it's moody, it's atmospheric. Split is just James McAvoy yelling and screaming and eating scenery for 120 fucking minutes. The fact that they felt like these two films could be joined together and it wouldn't be tonally incoherent, or Split wouldn't carry the day, in part because it was made 3 years ago instead of 20 years ago. Yeah, this was just a big, big, big mistake all around that will give him a Shyamalan to keep on making terrible movies for the next 20 fucking years.
Yeah, I guess so. I want to close on the larger meta argument that people are making that, like, the whole thing, just like with Lady in the Water, it's all about Knight's ego and Sarah Paulson and that Clover Society or whatever are the critics and normie audiences who didn't believe the superheroes were real and didn't believe in his powers and didn't believe that he was a great filmmaker. And these guys are like, no, I'm gonna put my talents out into the light. Everyone's gonna believe. Everyone will see. And I'm like, dude, no. Honey, no, stop it. But I will say nothing. I challenge 2019 to give me a greater laugh out loud moment this year than when Bruce Willis' son runs out towards a field of cops with guns drawn, being like, wait! You see, sometimes in comic books, people have tragic backstories where their parents die. And it was just baffling. I mean,
I printed out these Wikipedia pages. I'm going to hand them all out to everybody. This is what's going on. Look under the mythology section.
I understand in a Shyamalan movie, you have to deal with a certain amount of really awkward dialogue. Like in After Earth, there's literally a line where my suit's turning black. I like it, but I think it means something bad. that kind of stuff. And, yeah, you'll get no shortage of that in Glass.
You mean dialogue like, all right, be scientific, douchebag.
Yeah. How about his terrible cameo, too, that's apparently connecting all the films? It's like, oh, I mean, listen, I've been to a sports event. I even if a security guard shook me down, I wouldn't recognize him 15 years later.
Yeah.
It's absurd. That guy, maybe that guy's a superhero.
Maybe.
Remember Man.
And the thing that I love too is that M. Night Shyamalan, it's sort of like Spike Lee, his acting has gotten worse over time.
Yeah.
So there was a time when he could totally play a bit player totally perfectly adequately. But now he's mugging, he's practically winking at the camera, he's like, yeah, look at me, I'm back from those other movies. It's like, no. And I mean, I wrote about Stan Lee about kind of his performances were deliberately distracting. And that was kind of the idea, was to take you out of this movie that you're watching and connect it to a larger thing that you love. It's kind of the same thing here, except for the larger thing that you love being something you're incredibly irritated by and have no patience for anymore. So yeah, it really was just him putting his smudgy little fingerprints all over another crafter piece that could only have come from the mind of Freight Master M. Night Shyamalan.
Indeed. Well, I think we're done shitting on Glass, but we're not done shitting on Night. So let's move on.
It's still happening.
Oh, boy. All right, so it's Control, Nathan, and Clint time. Nathan, what were our options this time around?
Oh, Jesus fucking Christ. We once again wanted to explore the many, many, many nadirs of M. Night Shyamalan's motion picture career. So our two choices were Devil, which he wrote the story for and produced but did not direct, and The Happening, which astonishingly I don't think I've ever written about, despite it being one of the biggest disasters and one of the most maligned movies of the last decade.
God, imagine wanting to direct an M. Night script. Because I feel like, if anything, I think Knight's like directorial eye is at least slightly better than his screenwriting. Like, of any element that you would want him to do.
Yeah, it's astonishing. Like, yeah, I feel like he kind of became very successful very, very young. I mean, you look at The Buried Secret of M. Night Shyamalan. Buried Secrets, why the fuck would he agree, willingly participate in something that unbelievably self-indulgent, narcissistic, egomaniacal, crazy, unself-aware? And I think part of the reason is I believe when he made that, he was 33 or 34 years old and had astonishing, astonishing, astonishing success. So again, you kind of get this idea of like, I'm great, I can do anything, people love me, it's my time to shine. And that kind of narcissism and that kind of self-delusion and that inability to delineate between great ideas that result in movies like Unbreakable and The Sixth Sense and unbelievably terrible ideas like The Happening, you're not able to separate the two. So I think that's how you end up with motion pictures like The Happening.
Yeah. So, Eric, describe the plot of The Happening.
Well, The Happening is...
What happens in The Happening?
It's a Fluxist art movement. No. it's what happens when the plants get sick of us and they realize that humans have become a burden on society. The world. So they start forcing you to kill yourself through airborne release toxins.
Yeah, I guess so. And it's all just about like these couple days where this, well, happens. And one particularly stupid family is caught up in the middle of it. Where it's Mark Wahlberg's science teacher and Zooey Deschanel's doe-eyed wife, who's like kind of a mannequin, and these like weird, and these her their weird daughter, and some weird kids that they like bring along the way, and it's just a fucking mess.
Well, the thing that I love is this is some of the greatest, most exquisite miscasting in the history of film. I love that they didn't just cast Mark Wahlberg, who has the vibe of somebody who dropped out of high school so that he could commit hate crimes against Asia, not just as a science teacher and a science true believer, but basically as one of those science is badass bumper stickers brought to life. He is a sentient science worship, and he's so ridiculously, ridiculously wrong in that. I mean, his first line of dialogue addressing his high school science classes. You know, the bees, they're dying. What's going on? Why are the honeybees dying?
Where's the bees, bro?
Where's the bees, bro? Where are the bees? Come on, where are the bees?
Come on.
Where are the bees? Where did you leave the bees? And I also love that, again, this is M. Night Shyamalan's conception of human behavior. He starts
behavior? Behavior.
B-movie.
Does Mark Wahlberg's character love jazz?
He starts taunting this sort of male model looking hunky Frad Jack character by being like, yeah, you know, you think you're real handsome, real good looking, huh? Well, you know what's going to happen? Your looks are all going to fade 5 years from now, 10 years from now. You're not going to have nothing. You're going to be real ugly. You know what you need? You're going to need science. You need science, buddy.
Like, you're going to look like you're stung by a bunch of bees, bro.
Going to need science to fix your busted up face.
That is abusive. Secondly, Mark Wahlberg is telling somebody that they cannot coast on their good looks and that they need to be very smart and have a book education, because how else are they going to make hundreds of millions of dollars and become a world famous movie star / entertainment mogul? They need science, motherfucker.
Remember the time that he lets his class out, but then he like stops and says, hey, wait, nothing. What was the point of that scene?
They don't appreciate his science.
No.
Science!
Don't forget to do your homework. Eat 5 Wahlburgers.
It literally is a line of dialogue in this motion picture where he is in a state of crisis and literally utters the words, all right, be scientific, douchebag.
Yeah.
That is a line of dialogue that appears in this motion picture.
People, so relatable, Nathan.
That scene when he's going over like, oh, I gotta science it out. It's people are shooting themselves and everyone's like, tell us what to do. You're our leader. Why? Why is he the leader?
Because he knows about science.
He's Mark Wahlberg, motherfuckers. But also,
his life is about the scientific method, the scientific prospect, hypotheses. You know, he's doing all these things. He's like a Nobel Prize winner, except well, apparently, he's teaching high school.
Apparently, his life is also not about pleasing his wife, because there's a ridiculous subplot happening about trouble where they have trouble in paradise, and like his wife, played by Zooey Deschanel, is wrestling with the guilt of going out for tiramisu with a work colleague. They didn't sleep together. They didn't even kiss. She just thought about maybe doing it for a hot second, and she's been racked with guilt about that ever since. And that is still in her mind when the world's going to shit.
Some things are worse than adultery, like tiramisu.
Yeah. Well, I feel like there are two major challenges facing Zooey Deschanel and Mark Wahlberg's relationship here, one of which is an apocalyptic event that could destroy all of humanity. The second of which is she went out for tiramisu with a coworker.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which one is worse? You be the judge. They are basically treated like equivalent threats and equivalent dangers to this relationship that nobody could fucking possibly care about. The other reason why this is ridiculous this cast is in no universe, in no like Spider-Man universe, are Mark Wahlberg and Zooey Deschanel compatible? Are they talking about stuff, having conversations, well, doing both, it, falling genuinely in love with each other?
Both of these things are science-based problems, you know? It's like, you know, you need your book learning. You got to read the Kama Sutra. Got to please your wife.
And then the great thing about Zooey Deschanel's performance here is perhaps to distance herself, it feels like she's reading all of these lines for the first time, and she's making fun of them, and she's being a little sarcastic, and she's being insulting towards the script. And they're like, eh, you know what, whatever, you're a cute girl. I don't know how human beings behave. I also feel like the tiramisu thing happens because in M. Night Shyamalan's weird Boy Scout universe, sex doesn't exist. People aren't fucking. So the most they can do is to go.
People don't fuck in his universe, do they?
No, they really fucking don't, you know? They go out for dessert, and they're like, they think about going on a kissing date, but it doesn't happen. Well, and it takes an almost apocalypse to bring these people together.
All of his movies are like that, right? Like The Sixth Sense, there's marital problems because he's a ghost and Unbreakable. They're constantly fighting, you know?
That's true.
In After Earth, Will Smith's character is off in space too much. Yeah.
Signs. I think, doesn't Mel Gibson have a problem with his wife in that?
Well, the wife is dead.
Sure. Oh, yeah. See? Again. That's a problem.
I think they call that irreconcilable differences.
Well, the thing that's kind of fascinating to me about this is I feel like this is basically an environmental disaster movie, which is not something that you see a whole lot of today.
It's Hitchcock trying to do The Birds so
bad. You
do,
and you see these like weird, broad characters. Like there is a hippie botanist who
loves hot dogs.
Who is obsessed with hot dogs. And again, this is actual dialogue from the motion picture The Happening. You like hot dogs, right? They got a cool shape. They got protein. You know, hot dogs get a bad rap.
Yeah.
This is his, and this happens deep into an apocalypse. People are dying. They're committing suicide.
When he figures out it's the trees super quick, he's like, oh, it's plants. And then the twist is that he was right. It's the plants.
Wait, what you're saying, bro, is I have to defeat them with hot dogs? I gotta toss some dogs?
Throw hot dogs at a tree?
and again, kind of the money shot for this is you're all these people committing suicide, and there's no reason. It's supposed to be spooky. It's supposed to be a little bit J-horror. There's a real J-horror element to it.
Yeah.
But what I kept feeling like, this feels like I'm playing a really shitty video game, and people are so bored that they're just killing their characters. And they're like, this game isn't worth playing. It's dumb. It's gonna be impossible. I'm just going to fucking throw myself off a cliff.
Yeah, it feels like someone's playing The Sims and is just like locking people in a house with no doors.
Oh my God. And then at a certain point, they go to a farmhouse of an eccentric southern lady. And it's like Signs was like, what, 7 years earlier? Like, not every movie you make has to be a farmhouse based survival story. And they meet this woman who overacts even for someone in an M. Night Shyamalan. They're either overacting egregiously or underacting egregiously. There's very little appropriate acting, and everybody's either going way too hard or just not acting at all. And
what?
She's
acting, no,
she says, I see you eyeing my lemon drink. And he wants to say, like, hey, funny story, lady, apocalypse has happened, everybody's murdering themselves, kill, 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 you know, society has broken. And she's like, oh, don't tell me anything. I don't have a radio because I make my own beats and I raise my own. Like, listen, lady, I don't fucking care about you. For excited. And this movie also is 85 minutes long.
Yeah, that's right. It's so short.
God. And I appreciated that. You know,
yeah, I guess
they got me in and out, and you know, was it 2 hours and 9 minutes like Glass? But they realize what a fucking ridiculous piece of shit they have. And they let you out about 20 minutes early, which I appreciated.
What was the point of having John Leguizamo in this? He's like, he checks out early in a scene with Dante from Clerks.
Oh my God.
To see him getting work.
This scene where he's just like, okay, so you're scared. Let's do a math problem because I'm a math teacher.
Yeah. No, he's a statistician. And there's a 100%, you'll find his performance annoying and superfluous.
Whoops.
Maybe he's there to make Mark Wahlberg seem more realistic as a school teacher by comparison.
Truly survival of the fittest. But even before they get to the old lady's house, there's like that other scene where like the family has some other kid with them, and they go to like some other house and is knocking on their door.
They acquire John Leguizamo's kid because their relationship is just too fucking stupid and boring and low stakes for anybody to fucking care about them. It's like, seriously, the stakes of this are a couple whose marriage is threatened by tiramisu. Are they gonna like get back together? It's like, no, you gotta fucking have a child in peril. And even with a child in peril, I could not stop laughing at this movie. And some of it may have been a little bit intentional. There's that infamous scene where Mark Wahlberg figures things out and has a conversation with a tree.
The tree.
And the joke is that the tree is a plastic tree and ends up being like, yeah, this is pretty crazy. Womp
That's
womp.
Plastic plant.
I kind of wish
he got
the whole 9 yards and he had like a bottle of alcohol and then he like flipped it over like womp womp. It did a flip take.
Crazy
realized that he was having an animated conversation with a plastic tree. But again, that kind of raises the idea that on some level he must have known that he was making an astonishingly stupid
movie.
The mere act of making plants and trees the bad guys. And also the good guys. Did you guys get the sense that like I was rooting for them because humanity is so fucking stupid? I'm like, kill them.
Whoever
kill them
wins,
all.
We lose. Let's play
exactly.
By Alien versus Predator rules.
Also, the funniest part is when that kid gets shot with a shotgun, right?
Yeah. Oh my God, it's ridiculous. After he tries to convince them they're on the level by singing like, "I wanna keep on rolling," like that's how they convince them they're normal. Yeah. I'm shooting all of you.
Oh, I only know about science, bro. Let me sing a common song for these people.
Yeah. not you. Yeah. Oh man, and then like the movie literally just ends. They're like, "Well, I guess it's over."
Yeah. Well, but it came back again. And this time in France.
Oh my God, we also get that scene where there's that egghead talking on television about how this is all a reaction from the plants and whatnot. He's like figured it out, but everyone's not convinced because it hasn't happened elsewhere. Now, presumably, it'll happen in France and the whole thing will kick off and it'll convince everyone that it's really happening. And then I think we're going to get a preemptive strike. We're going to strike nature. We're going to do it. Oil rigs everywhere.
We need to build a wall around the forest.
We'll use lumber. They're trying to kill us. The trees are trying
Some
to kill
wooden
us.
Wooden slats from IKEA.
We're bringing paper back, folks.
So here's an idea. It's like Sharknado, except it combines The Happening and Split. So there's a happening, but it involves metahumans this time.
You know, they say a wall is old is medieval, but guess what's even older? Trees. Trees are the oldest walls. The history's first walls.
I also love the sound design of there being whistling all around. So you're like, oh, that's the whistling
gently
of the trees.
Gently rustling leaves.
The trees that are planning to murder everybody.
Yeah, and again, like you said, like the actual, like the gimmicky suicide scenes, which are ostensibly the bread and butter of this. Like some of them I like on a conceptual level, but others are just ridiculous. Like the videos that they keep watching of like the dude walking into the lion thing and just like casually having someone's like a lion rip their arm off, or
well,
the dude
the
walking in front of the giant industrial lawnmower.
That they're doing it so slowly is supposed to make it scarier and more moody and atmospheric. It actually just makes it hilarious and very silly and very goofy that these people are killing themselves in slow motion in ways that they should be able to pull out.
Yeah, like
at some point.
There's one shot that I kind of liked where it was like on a city street or something, and it involved like people killing themselves with a gun, and then you're following the gun as other people pick it up and shoot themselves, and like that moment I thought was kind of cool. But like these little isolated moments don't really like make a whole movie.
I loved that as Eric referred to the egghead guy at the very end describing how everything happened, and he totally says the exact same thing as the cool, hunky jock who somehow knows more about science than anybody else. When he says, yeah, that happens. It's science. You never know what's going on with science. Which, again, in The Happening, qualifies as a surprisingly intelligent, insightful comment. Yeah. Hey, it's nature. Who knows about nature?
I just loved how committed they were to calling it a happening. Like, whatever's happening is happening here. There appears to be an event happening.
Whatever's happening now is happening now.
Yeah, right. I half expected it to be an actual happening, like a performance art troupe, yes. Like getting up on the street and just doing a little bit about like capitalism or whatever.
Ken Kesey was there, the Mary Prankster. Yeah.
Oh, that'd be even better. Like it was a wide, like it was like a this art
plague
art
of performance
murder.
Artists.
Yeah,
it could be like the end of The Apple. And that could be The Happening. Yeah. And then The Happening, everybody went off to heaven in their giant hippie van.
Yeah,
and I'd be like, well, that actually doesn't make it any crazier than the way they actually do handle things.
Yeah, imagine if it was like a weird performative mass suicide that happened as a result of people being part of this performance art troupe who like wanted to prove that humanity was the culprit of a lot of terrible things on Earth.
Well, it felt like the world's most self-destructive flash mob, basically. Yeah, basically. Everybody get on the street, just, we're all going to kill ourselves.
Most of the time it's just a proposal, but
exactly,
this.
You know, and some of it'll be synchronized, it'll be choreographed, it'll just be, you know, freestyle your own death.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to stab yourself, you want to jump off a building, you do you, you know?
So yeah, what were some of our favorite individual moments of the most ridiculous thing that happened? Eric, what about you? Like we need to pinpoint one moment to wrap up The Happening.
The construction workers jumping was pretty fun. That's my highlight, really.
Nathan, what about you?
Hot dog talk for me. I also love that you have like a crazy comical hippie character. I wish he'd been played by Tommy Chong. And a movie called The Happening. And he's never like, there's a happening going on, man. It's happening. Can't you see it, man? Happening.
Dave's not here, man. He killed himself.
I think my favorite might have to be the private, like Private Gomer or whatever, played by Jeremy Strong from Succession, who literally reacts to something by saying, cheese and crackers. anyway, yeah, The Happening, the just one in a long line of shitty M. Night movies that he will never, ever, ever live down until the sun explodes or humanity is wiped out by a plague of wind.
And I gotta say, in my line of work on Wikipedia, I come across the phrase considered by many to be one of the worst films ever made. And after that, I'm like, well, that's a little bit harsh. That's a little bit over the top. With this, I can kind of see it. I mean, by any stretch of how you consider a movie bad, this has it in spades. And I mean that kind of as a positive thing. Like, I enjoyed watching this movie. It's incredibly stupid. I laughed at it a lot. It's super memorable. It's super unforgettable. And like on a style level, I mean, you know, it's very well done. It's very professional. But on a storytelling level, it deserves every last bit of mockery and derision heaped upon it.
Yeah, exactly. All right, let's move on. Okay, now we're leaving M. Night behind and going on to a different disaster. One that's very, very real. The Fyre Festival. In case you don't know, two different documentaries on the infamous Fyre Festival came out on various streaming services.
It's
on
the Lambada Effect.
Yes, there is the Deep Impact, which is Fyre, the greatest party that never happened on Netflix, from Chris Smith, a documentarian who's most known for making this great documentary called American Movie. And then there's Volcano.
He also did the Andy Kaufman, Jim Carrey doc that got a whole lot of attention.
Oh, yes, that's right. That's
right. Probably done the two, maybe the two best known Netflix documentaries. So yeah, he's had a heck of a comeback, Chris Smith. Really, really interesting dude.
Right, and then there's The Armageddon, which is Fyre Fraud on Hulu, which dropped, like, mysteriously. It was a surprise drop, like, 3 days before the Netflix one came out. We only knew about the Netflix one leading up to that, right? So, yeah, my impression was, watching two of them, and I reviewed the Netflix one for Consequence of Sound, there's a lot of back and forth happening right now in sort of the discourse about like the various ethical, you know, niggles about, you know, who's producing what and who gives what a fair shake. But I felt like in concert, the two documentaries offered a fairly comprehensive view of the Fyre Festival from different angles, right? Because there's the Netflix one that focuses more on like the slow motion train wreck of this thing starting, and like day after day after day, new problems happen and everyone's out of their element, and then it happens and then there's a fallout. And then Fyre Fraud is more about Billy McFarland, the guy largely responsible for it specifically, and kind of the influencer culture stuff.
Yes,
is that your
definitely
impression
too? It's kind of about the culture that created somebody like Billy McFarland, and how a sort of Fyre Festival embodied influencer culture in its most noxious and hilarious and terrifying form. I really, really enjoyed both. I found the Fyre Fraud one a little unbearable, and its need to explain, and its need to pontificate, and its... I felt like it
from
kind
a
of,
craft perspective, it's not as well made.
It felt like it had to dress all of these ideas up in like a tweed jacket and be like, but what does it say about society? What does it say about social media? What are our values? And then another thing they did was they used a lot of clips from like The Simpsons, from Seinfeld, to comment humorously on what's going on.
You can watch on Hulu, by the way.
All I could fucking think of was, wow, their licensing game is on point, and this is distracting me from what should be a fucking amazing story, and is an amazing story. I felt like anything that you do to distance yourself from the craziness and the insanity and the pressure and madness of the Fyre Festival is a big fucking mistake. And with Christmas movie, nothing separated you from this amazing story. And with the other one, I felt like there was just explain in a way that ended up not explaining anything. There was a desire to be intelligent in a way that just made it feel really fucking stupid and
right.
superficial.
The Netflix one is like going into all the workers' conditions and all the labor involved and the presumed possible blowjob.
Well, the nuts and bolts of it, you know, the fact right. that it takes yeah. so... And it was interesting to me because sort of festivals are a weirdly integral part of my career. I mean, when I was at the AV Club, they had a music festival, they had a comedy festival. Pitchfork, when I worked for them, like half of what they did was festivals. They had festivals in the States, they had festivals in Europe. I've been to the Gathering of the Juggalos 6 times in the Juggalo
I was about to ask how many times.
6 times. You know, I wasn't able to go this last time because my son was born, but I hope to rectify that. So it's interesting to me, and I talk about this in my article, one of the experiences at the Gathering of the Juggalos that made the biggest impression on me was they were giving a seminar at the 2017 gathering in Oklahoma City, and they were saying that, yeah, it kind of sucks that we're in a city with a big police presence that's cracking down on us, that's busting our balls. But to be honest, we almost didn't have a gathering this year because we couldn't find anybody to rent us porta potties. And you cannot have a festival unless you have shitters. Like, you literally, you will not get a permit to have a festival. Exactly. And that is one of 75 different things you need in order to have a festival. And the Fyre Festival didn't have any of that shit. They didn't have a stage. They didn't have accommodations. They didn't have any of the things that you need. And I guess kind of take a bit of a step back there. So basically the idea of the Fyre Festival was founded by these two gents, Billy McFarland, who figures very prominently in the Fyre Fraud documentary, and who was paid $250,000 to tell his story, which you would imagine kind of compromises it on an ethical perspective, and to a degree it does. And he just kind of spins his story. He just spins and spins and spins and spins. And he is a bit of a sociopath. He's a bit of a pathological liar. So you don't really feel like you get anything from him necessarily, with the exception of, and I feel like in both documentaries, there's an absolutely jaw-dropping moment. In the Fyre Fraud documentary, it's when Billy McFarland says, "We had $2 million worth of rentals on the island, ready to go for Fyre Festival patrons, and we lost the keys."
Yeah.
"We lost the keys." And he expects that to be a legitimate excuse to be like, well, anybody could lose $2 million worth of keys to something that would have prevented a disaster from happening, a festival apocalypse from happening. And then in the other documentary, there's this wonderful moment where this lovely, lovely, lovely fellow, this older gay gentleman who's been working very hard on the Fyre Festival, he gets a call from Billy McFarland, who says, You know, the moment has come. You've got to take one for the team. What I need you to do right now is to go over to customs. They're holding all this water. And in order to get them to release that water to have this festival, I'm going to need you to suck the custom guy's dick. Yes. And you're like, holy fucking shit. Whoa, whoa, whoa. What universe are we in here? And he says, and I was willing to do that. I was willing to suck a dude's dick to make sure that a bunch of douchebags could party on yachts while watching Blink 182.
that's another thing. It's who's going to this? The lineup is Blink 182 and Ja Rule, and you're gonna,
but he's
you're
not gonna, even Ja performing. That's he's part of the weird thing about it. He's just, you know, he's just the
it's
the
like Major Lazer.
My
shit.
God, I watched both docs, and yeah. I just assumed Ja Rule would be performing.
You would imagine no. So, but no, it's his technological, it's his business expense. It's the business expense you would expect from a dude who.
It's his
got out of jail recently
after.
From a 2-year stint for tax evasion. And here's the thing. If a dude doesn't pay the government the money that he owes them and then goes to prison for that, you don't want to get in jail. You don't get business with this guy. He's not going to pay you money for that.
Well, and that's one of the most startling moments of the Netflix one is that conference call after the debacle where like the workers are like saying like, hey, so like we committed fraud, right? And John Rule's like, no, it's not fraud. It's not fraud. Think of it as like false advertising.
it's alternative facts. Alternative facts going on here.
Yeah. Exactly.
And again, kind of the way that this whole thing happened was they had a fuck ton of money and they used that fuck ton of money to pay literally 10 of the hottest and most expensive supermodels in the world to do a commercial stash photo shoot / Instagram thing where they all hung out and where Fire Island was to be. And they said, you know, party at Pablo Escobar's favorite private island, and they were not supposed to use that at all. And people were just intoxicated by it. And of the 10 supermodels, only one of them actually acknowledged that this was an advertisement and that she was paid to do so, and that she wasn't just super excited about this festival that nobody had ever heard of. You know, people like Kendall Jenner, one of the kind of fascinating aspects to me was good music was listed as one of the performers. And that's very, very ambiguous because good music ostensibly is Kanye West, who runs Good. That's like his vanity label. And then, you know, his proteges. Alternately, it's a bunch of motherfuckers you've never heard of. And nobody's going to be fucking shocked if Kanye doesn't fly to a concert that he's ambiguously ever supposed to appear in the first place.
Kendall could have saved the entire thing if she just brought a Pepsi can down to Fire Island. And
that is so true. So they had 6 months to make everything happen. And again, I think kind of one of the differences between the documentaries is I feel like Fire Fraud, this is about this as a crime. This is about a hoax. This is about a Ponzi scheme. Whereas with Chris Smith's movie, I think there was more of the sense of all of these people were trying to make this happen. They were trying to make the impossible happen. They're just like, if we just have enough luck, if we just have enough will, if we have enough money, we can make the impossible happen through sheer force of will. Whereas the Fire Fraud kind of makes it very apparent this was never going to succeed because it was a criminal operation more than anything else.
Right, and that's the interesting thing because you mentioned the $250,000 paid to Billy McFarland, which, you know, in and of itself is a bit of an ethical thing, but then that very same documentary shoots over at the, you know, takes pot shots at the Netflix documentary because Jerry Media, the social media company that was responsible
for it,
produced
Jerry.
It.
Yeah. Say
it's fuck Jerry. Fuck Jerry.
We all must be
it's
reverent
a family
and
show,
respectful.
Nathan.
Respectful enough. It's fuck Jerry.
It's fuck Jerry.
The good people at Fuck Jerry deserve to be, you know, acknowledged.
Acknowledged
all their
correctly.
All their
fine, yes.
Glory.
But they produced the documentary too. So like, you know, looking back on it, like I guess to a certain extent, Netflix lets Fuck Jerry off pretty easy. But also like they never make it seem like everything's going hunky dory. There is this sense that like all these people are like, we might be able to make it work. But then like also even after we realize it's not going to work, they have our paychecks hostage.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, too, is I feel like nobody did due diligence because I think people assume that things are on
diligence.
The level. You know, I think people are going to assume that, you know, if you're booked to perform at a festival and you were being paid twice your usual rate, which was the case with Fyre Festival, that it's not an elaborate Ponzi scheme put on by a pair of criminals out to defraud the people with. And it also, it feels like drugs were a huge, huge, huge part of this. And they hint at that without ever really being able to go into it. I kind of felt like one of the crazy takeaways that I got from this is like, I will watch 6 more hours of documentaries about this. I will listen to a podcast. I will watch a fucking movie about this. Who would you cast as Billy McFarlane and Ja Rule?
Oh, God. Billy McFarland, maybe Seth MacFarlane. I'm trying to think of, like, because there's two different looks for Billy McFarland, right? Because there's, like, at the time it's happening, he's a little portlier. He's got a bit of a pop belly over his cargo shorts. But then he's very, like, for Fyre Fraud, he's very clearly been, like, working out with his, like, trainer girlfriend for, like, months. And he's, like, a svelte sort of Silicon Valley type. I don't know. Maybe Armie Hammer. Maybe Armie Hammer could pull it off.
I feel like a young Ben Affleck would have been very, very good for that.
Yeah.
I will say for Billy, Mark Wahlberg, and for Ja Rule, M. Night.
There you go. Here's the thing. Why can't Ja play himself? He totally would.
That's true.
Here's actually a question going back there. This is a question I had pretty late into The Happening. Would The Happening be a better movie with M. Night Shyamalan in the Mark Wahlberg role?
Oh boy!
I don't know.
I doubt it. It'd be more of a fascinating disaster, even more so. I think
it'd be kind of like when Two Jigs was going to star Robert Evans, and they're like, "Oh wait, that's maybe not such a great idea." See, but I feel like he would have been a lot more convincing as a science teacher,
and
a lot more convincing about somebody who knows about science.
Hey, that's a stereotype, Nathan, and I will not have that on my show.
He's a doctor, for fuck's sakes. We've established. I'm guessing that you can't be a medical doctor unless you know a bunch of shit about science.
No, but
he also made a movie about how science is good and maybe we don't deserve to live. I believe in both of those, although I feel like he could have expressed them in any more forceful and entertaining fashion.
See, I thought your initial proposal was, what if The Happening happened at Firefest?
I would have fucking loved insane. That. And yeah. It would not
you
take
know
much...
There's a found footage horror movie waiting to happen about like a Firefest full of
life. Or like a Spring Breakers sequel. Yeah, at Fyre Festival, Jodie Hill and Danny McBride, I feel like they could have an amazing, amazing time
with
the story and these characters and kind of the world that it takes. You know, actually, I think Sofia Coppola could do
maybe,
a really,
like kind
really
of a bling ring mode.
Yeah. Doing like a really weird, interesting, artsy sort of Fyre Festival movie. and again, there are just so many great moments in it, like the notorious sandwich, where they really, you know, they said, oh, we're going to have $6 million in gourmet food from the greatest chefs in the world. And the iconography, probably the dominant iconography of the Fyre Festival, was a cheese sandwich and the processed cheese and the, like a lettuce salad thing going on right next to it.
And so I'm envisioning a Sausage Party sequel
where
that sandwich talks.
I like that.
Yeah, the sandwich is the hero also trying to escape the fucking festival.
I like that.
Yeah.
There we go. Yeah, I mean, and, you know, I think one of the reasons why there's so much demand for this festival is obviously, I mean, it was such a huge social media debacle, right? It was this, and they mentioned it in both documentaries, like one of the reasons we're so fascinated by it is it's kind of this, I mean, it's the ultimate Schadenfreude, right? Where it's seeing rich, white, young, entitled millennials getting their due. And I think I kind of wish both documentaries dug a little deeper into why that is. I don't know.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, I feel like there's this innate default hatred towards influencers because the idea is like, oh, there are these people who are superficial, who are glossy, whose job it is to be sexier and hotter and to have a more exciting life. So I think there's this combination of envy and desire. I kind of feel like the whole concept of the influencer is that that's somebody who you want to fuck or be or some combination of the two and that you express that by buying the same sunglasses that they do. It's a weird idea. Yeah, and a creepy idea. And I think people are hostile to the idea of people who had so much money to waste on something that they knew almost nothing about. That if you were going to spend $27,000 to be at a villa on the beach watching
for Blink-182.
Exactly, for Blink-182, then like you deserve to get ripped off and you deserve to get fucked over. And I feel like people have empathy and sympathy only for the Bahamanians, the people who worked, who got fucked over and were just doing their job. And were just trying to make people, you know, lives not terrible.
Yeah, I was very heartened to see that restaurant owner at the very end of the Netflix one, like, there was a huge crowdfunding campaign to, like, help her recoup the money that she lost having to pay off all her workers. So, like, at least there was, like, a little bit. Not that, I mean, I hate that it, sort of in today's version of capitalism, that has to be the kind of thing that, like, restores people to some sort of equilibrium. Like, it's kind of like people getting GoFundMes for their emergency medical expenses.
Outlaw economic justice. You know, the world is an unbelievably shitty place, but GoFundMe can make it a little less shitty.
Yeah.
Unless it's an elaborate con, as is sometimes the case.
Patreon.com/NathanRibbitsHappyCast.
We're building the wall. We got the GoFundMe up.
Yeah. Oh, God. I can't.
That was a con, right?
That was totally a con. They removed all of
it. Shockingly, that was a con.
Even if it wasn't a con, there's no way to give that to the government to build the wall.
Well, my whole thing too is Donald Trump likes to pretend that he has $10 billion. This wall will cost $6 billion. Hey, you can fund it yourself, you piece of shit.
Yeah,
you like to pretend that you have billions of dollars. You like to pretend that money doesn't matter to you. You like to pretend that you like the American people. This is a way to do all of that at one time. But anyway.
Right. Well, and then going back to Billy McFarland too, like, it feels like the whole Fyre Festival thing was born of that kind of, you know, dare I say it, this millennial impulse to be like, we can do anything. So all we have to do is say we're going to do it and then figure it out later. So it's that say yes, then figure it out later thing. But, like, the problem was he did that to a completely impossible task.
Well, and also I think it's kind of interesting that this kind of began as a way to promote the Fyre app. The app, I guess the idea being that, you know, it'd be like the Lyft or the Uber of booking gigs. And they wouldn't have to go through, you know, William Morris agencies anymore. You could just, you know.
But that's surge pricing, though.
You could totally message Coleman, like, hey, I've got $175,000. Can you come to my nephew's bar mitzvah?
But even that is flawed, because then, like, is Coldplay going to be sitting around on this app, or their guy at William Morris is going to be the one checking it?
Well,
you know?
And also, I don't think William Morris is excited about being elbowed out of the booking business by Ja Rule and a 26-year-old on a lot of Adderall, you know?
Right.
Maybe the agencies arranged the downfall. It was all in the lab.
Fyre Festival was an inside job.
Yes, but if Clover Society.
If you believe Ja Rule's Twitter feed and Wine Earth
Jet Fuel can't melt cheese sandwiches.
He was set up, man. He was set up. The victim in all of that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's funny because, like, in between Billy and Ja Rule, there's actually, like, a couple of other really interesting, colorful characters that I wish we'd gotten more of. I want an entire documentary about that Grant guy. The marketing director, the jittery marketing director,
who was completely
out of his element.
I liked a 23-year-old who was like, "You're booking all the bands now," and he's like, "Google booking bands,
right?"
but yeah, I guess there's this idea that, you know, the old gatekeepers aren't important anymore. We can do it ourselves. You know, the sky's the limit. And this, again, illustrated by maybe we kind of need the old gatekeepers. Yeah. But again, it's fascinating to me that it's having such a cultural moment right now. You know, like, everybody's talking about Fyre Festival and it has heat. And it's very, very bad heat. But I can't help but feel like that heat is going to lead to more Fyre Festival-related things. And I'm welcoming it because, my God, it's such a fascinating boondoggle that says so much about what horrible people we are individually and as a culture. And I guess I just love stories about narcissists and cons. And this is the ultimate story about the ultimate narcissist and the ultimate con artist.
Nice. I think it's
or
a good
is
enough.
It?
Oh, no. Well, I think that's a good enough note to end that on. So, yeah, let's move on. All right, now it's time for podcast recommendations. Nathan, what podcast are you recommending this week?
This is going to be phenomenally pointless, but I'm going to recommend a little-known podcast called Dirty John. It took me a very, very long time to actually catch up with it. I was watching the television version with Eric Bana, which is very, very entertaining and very, very dark. And so I've been listening to the epic, serial popular podcast about Dirty John, who is maybe the worst person in the world. I feel like these last two episodes have all been about terrible people and crazed narcissists. And oh boy, he certainly qualifies for that. And yeah, I just listened to the podcast where they talked about the kind of a related murder where some... God, the world is a horrible place. Somebody murdered his wife in basically cold blood, premeditated, and spent less than 3 years in prison. And that in itself, I think, could make for its own podcast. That in itself could be its own movie miniseries. And yeah, it's utterly, utterly, utterly fascinating. So if you have not, listen to Dirty John, because holy fuck, is that ever an entertaining and horrifying podcast.
Nice. Eric, do you have a podcast you'd like to recommend?
Yeah, I'm going to do something very self-serving and shitty and say, check out my TJ Hooker podcast, because it's the most useless thing on the internet, and I know that. So I feel okay plugging it here in this segment. It's tjhookerpodcast.com, and what we do is we're going through every single episode of TJ Hooker that has aired, the William Shatner cop show from 1982 to 1986.
His most iconic role.
Yes, definitely. I think so.
Yeah. That's Heather Locke there too, right?
Yes, yeah, definitely. She's nice, all over nice. That.
Cool. Mine is, I'm just going to rep something, like, because I've sort of run out of new podcasts to listen to for this that I haven't already recommended. So I'm going to pick one last one. It's the Bon Appetit Foodcast. I'm someone who loves to cook kind of almost pathologically. I like to keep my sort of hands busy, and like whenever I'm not typing stuff, I'm cooking stuff, and I love long, drawn out processes and learning about food. So I like to watch, I like to read Bon Appetit recipes and look at their YouTube cooking shows and stuff, and they have a little podcast called the Bon Appetit Foodcast, where it's basically all the personalities that people associate with Bon Appetit. Like, there's Brad Leone, who runs a thing called It's Alive, where he talks about fermentation, and then there's like all these other sort of chefs that when you watch all their videos, you sort of get to know as a personality, that kind of Food Network shit. It's kind of a rotating basis where they'll talk about a different kind of ingredient. Like, there's entire episodes just about rice. Or their most recent one is literally just about like making coffee better. Really nice sort of essential stuff, and it's wonderful casual listening. So I recommend the Bon Appetit Foodcast. All right, let's move on. Okay, now it is time for the mailbag. So if you want to mail us, if you want to send us mail that we will read and talk about on the show, you can go to asknathanrabenshappycast@gmail.com. This one's from Stephen Kendall, who I believe is one of our, the patron who boosted our, boosted their pledge this month. So thank you so much, Stephen. Hi guys. Inspired by Nathan's piece on the hand job in Hyde Park on Hudson, what are some possibly obscure scenes from TV or film that are forever burned into your brain? For me, it's the Neosporin song from Kung Pao Enter the Fist. Me too, Steven. I'll carry that with me forever. Nathan, what about you? What weird obscure scene is just burned into your brain?
This is an easy one for me, and probably not a big surprise for readers or listeners, and that is the Turtle Club scene in the motion picture Master of Disguise, the Dana Carvey vehicle. And in it, his character, Pistachio Disguisey, decides that he is going to sneak into the Turtle Club to get relevant information. And then in order to blend in with people, he will look and act as much like a turtle as humanly possible. Something that involves shouting the word turtle, biting somebody, spinning around on the ground. And it's one of the worst scenes of all time. One of the things that I will never forget about it is that it apparently was taped on 9/11. So that is
never forget.
That is an unbelievably terrible scene and a terrible movie that I will never forget.
Eric, what about you?
Well, I've got a few. I mean, I had a very unconventional upbringing, so a lot of this stuff is like trauma from youth. Like, for instance, I saw the motion picture Cruising with my mother.
Ooh, wow.
When I was like 10, 11, I don't know.
Wow.
But one of the ones
I
watched.
Where were your hankies? Where's the red hanky? Where's the blue hanky?
Yeah. bend over and I'll show you.
Ooh.
So the one that I've selected for this question is The Dark Backward, the 1991 movie with Judd Nelson and Bill Paxton. Have you seen this, Nathan?
I have. I haven't actually wrote about it for Control Nathan Rabin 4.0.
I haven't
seen this. And I got to say that Bill Paxton's performance for that sticks the fuck with me. I think
about that fairly often.
Like, I'm not a huge fan of the... Actually, I had the director on here not too long ago.
Oh, really?
I'm not a huge fan of the movie, but my God, everything that Bill Paxton does is so crazy and so intense.
I have never gone back. One
of my favorite Bill Paxton performances, even though I'm not sure it's good or bad, is there's just so much of it.
Yeah, I have not gone back, so I can't really identify if it's good or bad. It's just something that's been seared in my brain throughout all these years is Bill Paxton eating this like green rotten chicken that he got out of the trash or something.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I remember that as well. It's very, very creepy.
I think about that once a month.
Mine has to go. Honestly, I could probably also pick a million different things from Kung Pao Enter the Fist, because I was introduced to that at like just the right time, and I'm almost terrified to go back and watch it. But I think another one that might apply is there's a scene from John Landis's The Stupids that I have legitimately used in auditions before. And I don't know if you've seen John Landis's The Stupids.
Oh, I've seen John Lennon's. John Lennon's. John Landis and John Lennon's The Stupids.
Yeah.
The very stupid love.
There is a scene in which Tom Arnold's character, Stanley Stupid, is attempting to hide clandestinely while watching an arms deal that he thinks is like a meeting of a secret cabal of people who steal trash. And in order to do that, he hides behind a bush. And he sticks like pieces of like foliage to his blue suit. And he's like, okay, in order to be like a bush, I have to think like a bush. And he goes into this entire monologue in which he successfully and instantly convinces himself that he is a bush. And so he is then surprised that he has human features. I'm the first bush in history with legs. I can walk. And I have the entire spiel just memorized. Oh, gaze ye unbelievers upon this miracle, this walking bush, half man, half plant. He dwells in two worlds, but is the master of both. Behold, man bush, I am nature's greatest wonder.
And I think, so did you get the part?
Yes. And the Stupids 2, even stupider, starts filming in a few months.
Oh, terrific.
Right? So it's just one of those weird pieces of useless ephemera that will forever replace more important information. Yeah. It will be with me until my dying day. And I love that movie in ways that are not appropriate. So yeah, thanks, Steven, so much for asking that question. If you want to be cool like Steven, A, pledge to us, B, increase your pledge after some time, and C, send us mail at asknathanrabinshappycast@gmail.com. Let's move on. All right, gents, let's close out with happy places. Nathan, what's your happy place this week?
Well, this one is going to be about 2.5 hours ago, sitting on my couch watching The Happening again, and being reminded of the intense pleasure that I get from the right, wrong, terrible, terrible, terrible movie. Because, yeah, that's kind of the definition of so bad, it's kind of great. My happy place is watching the wonderfully, wonderfully, wonderfully stupid, just as god-awful as its reputation would suggest, motion picture The Happening.
Nice. Eric, what about you?
Well, it's sort of similar. I've lately, on the program We Hate Movies, we have this side show we started doing called the Gleep Glossary on our Patreon, and I'm reading all this old discontinued Star Wars EU now, the Legends stuff, like the stuff that's been thrown out twice, and it's just so fun and dumb, and it's just bewildering. Is that a Star Wars character name?
Bewildering
how I would ever have even got into it.
Spoiler alert, he's secretly a Jedi.
Yeah, bewildering. Yeah, the Jedi. But yeah, it's just this kitsch pulp crap.
I think Bewildering was B. Arthur's character's name in the Star Wars holiday special.
I think you're right. She was a bartender in that.
What's one absolutely crazy character that you've come across in the podcast?
Well, the first one we did that's up is Figrin Dan of the Modell Nodes, the leader of the Cantina
Band. Oh, the Jizz Whalers themselves.
Yes. We talked all about jizz whaling. Did they go to Jizz Juilliard? I don't know. You know, so we go into their bios.
It's Goulliard, by the way.
Oh, yes, of course.
Yes. my happy place is kind of a major rebranding for me. For the last 7 years, I think I probably mentioned this on previous shows, but for the last 7 years, I was the co-host of a podcast called Alcohollywood, where myself and my co-host, Jared, would talk about different movies and sort of make, you know, good or bad movies no matter what, and we'll make a custom cocktail and a drinking game out of them. 7 years is a really long run for a podcast, and I'm very blessed that it's given me the opportunity to become sort of a legit film critic and meet Nathan, who has been on the show and like leading to this job and a bunch of other jobs. But as that stuff has expanded, I've decided to rebrand a little bit. This Friday, February 1st is the launching of our rebranded site called The Spool. So if you go to thespool.net, it'll actually be live by now. You'll be able to see that. It'll be the home of whatever writing I'm doing. It's kind of my own happy place. My writing that isn't sold to other outlets and several other people who gracious enough to write for me. That's great. I also started a weekly interview podcast that I repped on the show last time, more of a comment really. And then we're actually going to start a TV podcast called Hall of Faces with my good friend Allison Shoemaker, and that'll be the TV component. It's basically going to be this big overarching film and TV website that I'm hoping to build up slowly but surely. But if anyone wants to check that out, I would really, really appreciate it. It's going to be a big step for me, but I'm looking forward to it. All right. I think that pretty much wraps up this episode of Nathan Rabin's Happy Cast. Eric, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Once again, tell people where they can find you.
Oh, yeah. You could find We Hate Movies at WHMPodcast.com. We also just launched content on YouTube, YouTube.com/We Hate Movies, where we actually have a conversation on Glass up now.
Nice. Are you on Twitter?
Yeah, at Eric Siska or Shishka. It's ERICSZYSZKA.
Excellent. That wraps it up for this episode of Nathan Rabin's Happy Cast. You can find me on Twitter at Alcohollywood and Nathan at Nathan Rabin. Subscribe, rate, and review us on iTunes or your favorite podcatcher, and pledge to our Patreon at patreon.com/NathanRabinsHappyCast. Our theme song is by John Beacon. Check out his stuff at johnbeacon.com. Until next time, I bid you a hearty whoop whoop.